Well, good morning. I'm Jason. I'm one of the deacons here at the church, and we've been working through the book of Judges this summer, and it's kind of a hard book. And if you haven't been with us, again, I want to say welcome. We are very blessed to have you here today. I feel very blessed as one of the members of this church that they allow me to come up and teach once in a while and talk about God's Word. And today we're going to be talking about Judges 19, which is a very hard story. In fact, this is going to be, I'm going to issue a warning label now. If you have young children, this may be really hard for them to hear. It may be hard for you to hear. So if you feel uncomfortable with some of the stuff that you're going to hear today, we have a wonderful Sunday school room just out the back. We'll be happy to help your kids get set up there. So having said that warning, we're going to kind of dive in here. The theme this summer has been character in the midst of chaos. And what you're going to find as we talk today about Judges 19 is there's not much character left. There's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of evil. And it's going to seem really dark. In fact, I think this is one of the darkest chapters in the Bible, if not the darkest. It's really painful to read. I know for a lot of you it's going to be really painful to hear what we're going to talk about today. In fact, I kind of hope it is, because that would mean you're not kind of calloused over to this sort of thing. I hope to shed some light and some hope on this passage today as well. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to open us up in prayer, and then we're going to just start walking our way through this. Father, thank you for the opportunity to teach about your word, God. You have given us your entire word for our edification, God. I thank you that you have instructed us through 66 books in your Bible, God. And I just pray that you would help us to remember today that every one of those books is meant to teach us something, God. And I pray that you would bless the words that I share today, God, that you would give people open hearts, God, and that if people are stirred or moved and don't know where to go, that they would come and talk to someone about what we're going to talk about today. I pray this in your name. Amen. I'm going to move that so I don't trip on it. I'm going to start by reading Judges 19, verses 1 to 3. It says, "In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine was unfaithful to him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys, and she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him." So right away in verse 1, we come back upon this theme that we've heard about a few times in the book of Judges, this idea that there's no king in Israel. And in the Bible, when you hear something repeated again and again, it's important for you to kind of sit up and take notice of that. We need to focus and realize there's an important message in what's being communicated there. I kind of think about that in two ways. One way is that there literally was no physical king in Israel. There was no kingly line, which we would hear about in future books. And if we know anything about the kings of Israel, not only were they military and political leaders, but the kings of Israel were supposed to be spiritual leaders of the country as well. David was a great example of somebody who most of the time was very good at leading his people spiritually and pointing them toward God. But a point that Mike and Rob have both made in past weeks is that when it says there's no king in Israel, it also means that the people were not following after the God of heaven. They were not following after the King of heaven. They had no moral compass. They had no law that they were following after. And because they were lacking that moral compass, they were not listening to their sense of right and wrong. And as you can see, this tendency to focus on themselves leads to sin of the darkest color. In these first few verses, we also meet the first few characters of Judges 19. The first person we meet is a Levite who is living in the hills outside of Ephraim with his concubine. A Levite is a member of the tribe of Levi, and if you remember the Old Testament, the tribe of Levi was set up to be the priestly tribe. This was the group of people who were to offer sacrifices to God on behalf of the people and to make petitions to God on behalf of the people. And we don't necessarily have a good parallel to that today. But maybe the best way we can think about it is these are often the people who were kind of pastoring over Israel, pastoring over them. And so basically a Levite was supposed to be a man of God. We also discover that the Levite had with him a concubine. And a concubine is another one of those things that's kind of hard to understand exactly what it is. In some regards, a concubine is very similar to what a slave was. A concubine was a woman who was obtained for the purposes of bearing children for somebody. So in some respects, we need to think of her like a slave. But in other respects, she's like a wife because, again, she's bearing children. And in fact, in Judges 19, verse 3, she's referred to as his husband, or the Levite is referred to as his husband. And so, in some regards, we need to think about this as a marriage. And as I talk about this, I want us to think about it in that role as well, that this was a wife to her husband. Anyway, we discover that the concubine is unfaithful to her husband, and so she runs away to her father's house. She's committed adultery, and so she flees and goes back to Bethlehem where her father is. This is one of those places in the Bible where I would like a lot more detail as to what was meant by that. Why did she go back? You know, I wonder, was she, before she was married to the Levite, was she really in love with some other guy and she ran back to him? Or was the Levite very harsh with her, maybe even abusive toward her, and she was scared of what might happen if he were to find out about this? We really don't know, but what we do discover is that she goes back to her father's house and stays with him. And now we find out that she is there for 4 months. That's a long time. You know, I'm wondering, what's her husband doing in those 4 months that she's gone? What is the Levite doing this whole time that she's away? You know, if Heather and I have a fight about something, even about something very serious, and I wait 4 months to go find her, somebody please come talk to me. But anyhow, 4 months later, the Levite gets up and goes to find her and finds her at her father's house. And he comes there, and her dad seems very glad to see him, which also clues me in that this is more than just a slave relationship. The father-in-law genuinely seems very glad to see the Levite. In fact, in verse 3, it says, he came with joy to meet him. You know, he probably approved of the union, wanted to see them reunite and get back together. And so he invites him into his house, and he shows just remarkable hospitality to him. And it talks about in verses 4 to 9, which we're not going to review here, but it talks about how much that this father-in-law does for the Levite, provides meals for him, gives him shelter, feeds the servants, feeds the animals, and really encourages him to stay. This idea of hospitality was so important in the Near East, and in fact, it still is very important. They make a much bigger deal out of hospitality than I think a lot of us do. So anyhow, they stay there for a number of days, and they are in the house, and the Levite's trying to get away, and he's trying to get away, and he's trying to get away with his wife to go back home, to go back to Ephraim. And eventually, we find that 5 days later, he's able to get back on the road and start heading back toward Ephraim. And they got started on the road a little bit later than what they had hoped. The father-in-law was still pressuring him to stay, but they managed finally to get going. A little later again than they had hoped, but they had a long journey. We know that it's 6 miles from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. And when you're walking, that's a long walk. So I want to pick up reading again, starting in verse 10. says, "But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus," that is Jerusalem. "He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, 'Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it.'" So they've reached the outskirts of Jebus, or Jerusalem, and the reason it's called Jebus is it's not, they're not Israelites living there now. It's Jebusites who are foreigners, and they're no doubt very tired and ready to rest, and so they come upon the city, and the servant, you know, probably says to his master, "Master, please, can we stop? I'm tired. We've been walking all day. We got a late start. It's getting late. Can we stop?" And the Levite says to him, "You know what? Let's keep going. The city is full of foreigners. I'm scared of what might happen here. There's probably some potential danger. Let's just keep rolling on. Gibeah is not that much farther." And so they decide to move on. And you know, I can confess that I can relate to that. About 20 years ago, I was in Wheaton, Illinois, visiting a girlfriend I had at that point, and had to drive back to Oostburg, where I lived in Wisconsin, and so I had to drive through Chicago. And sometime around midnight, I got lost in the middle of Chicago near a place called Cabrini Green, which is a very, very dangerous section of Chicago, famous for its gang activity. And I'm completely lost, and I'm looking for any way that I can find my way out there. People burning fires on their front lawn, and I'm just scared out of my mind. And I cannot recall many times in my life being more scared. I would not have wanted to stay there that night. I was scared of being in a place where there were foreigners to me. So I can relate to this idea. And so they decide they're going to push on. Starting at picking it up again at verse 12, it says, "And his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside into this city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah.' And he said to his young man, 'Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah.' So they passed on and went their way. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend their night at Gibeah, and went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night." So they walk the remaining 2 miles, and they get to Gibeah, and they decide that they're going to stay there, because now the sun's going down. We find out that evening has come. You know, you can think of dusk, where you can still see a little bit, but it's really starting to get pale outside. And they decide to stay there because we've learned that in this city, it belongs to Benjamin. Benjamin is another one of the tribes of Israel. So the people who live there, these Benjaminites, were part of the clan. Presumably, these are the good guys. And so they decide this is going to be the place they're going to stay. And so they go into town, and they're looking for somewhere to stay, but they don't find any house that takes them in. We find that no one offers them any help. You know, they probably are going door to door, saying, "Hey, we're looking for a place to board for the night. Is there anyone who can help us?" And no one is helping. And it's getting later and later, and they're getting turned away from door by door. Now, if you remember, I said a few minutes ago, the people of this region valued hospitality. So you have to wonder what was going on at this point. Do they know that there's something wrong in Gibeah? Do they know that there's something wrong in their city? These people who would normally bend over backwards to help somebody were now inhospitable. They weren't inviting people in. They, in fact, thought it was best to avoid trouble altogether. And so without other options, the Levite and his servant and his concubine go into the city square and camp there because they think, maybe this is the safest. At least if we can maybe avoid wild animals or getting attacked out in the wilderness. And so they think this is really the safest option for them. Soon, though, we discover that an old man, a sojourner, who's also from Ephraim, comes in. I'm going to read on here, starting in verse 16. It says, "Behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjaminites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?' And he said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to the house of the Lord, but no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for our donkeys, with bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything. And the old man said, peace be to you. I will care for all your wants, only do not spend the night in the square. So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet, and they ate and drank. So this sojourner is tired from the day's work, and he is coming down from the field, and he sees this small band of campers out in the city square, and he knows they're making a mistake by staying out there, and so he decides to find out a little bit more about them, and he goes and he asks them, he says, who are you and where do you come from? And he finds out that this Levite is from the same place that he is. And so he says to him, you know, it's not safe. I want you to come on in and stay with me. He knows that a priest and a servant boy and a young woman out in the city are in danger. So he says to them, why don't you come and stay with me? I'll provide for all your needs. And so they go home and they wash their feet and they have a meal together and have some drink. And we will learn here in a couple minutes that they became merry. They were enjoying their time together. You know, I have to wonder, what was their dinner conversation like? Did they exchange small talk? Were they talking about what it was like to live in Ephraim? Did the sojourner ask the Levite what it was like to be a Levite, to be of that line? Did they talk what it was like to be in their different families? Did he even allude to the fact that it might be dangerous to live there? All we really know is that it says that they were making their hearts merry. You know, they were enjoying one another's company. But here is where the story takes a really bad turn. You're going to wonder, in fact, whether this story is true. You're going to wonder why God would choose to include this story in the Bible. You're going to realize in these next couple paragraphs what the opposite of character looks like. You're going to realize that what it looks like when people live without a moral compass. So I want to pick up in verse 22. It says, as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him. So as the people of the house are having fun, enjoying one another's company and making merry, they hear a banging on the door. And we find that these worthless fellows from the town are coming and asking for this man to be sent out. You know, they probably had been watching this band of travelers in the city square, and been plotting how they were going to approach or attack this group of people. But now they've seen him go into the sojourner's house, and they decide now's the time to attack. The merriment that had been taking place in the house is now gone. They had to be filled with fear at this point. The merriment has changed to fear. You know, this house probably wasn't well fortified, certainly not steel reinforced doors, not double paned glass on the windows. They could probably hear these men outside laughing and cackling and joking and plotting about what they were going to do. So these men tell the sojourner, they say, bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him. Know is one of those English words that often loses meaning when we hear it. Know, you know, when we think of know in English, we think of to understand something better or to have more information about something. But in Hebrew, the word yada, which is to know here, is a euphemism for sex. In Genesis 4:1, we see it where it says, Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore a son. So there's this euphemism there for sex. The Levite would have known that. He would have understood that this was a euphemism for that. But he would have also, if he remembered anything about his training, about the Bible, he would have remembered the story in Genesis 19. Genesis 19 was Sodom and Gomorrah. And indeed, in that story, the word no is also used, where they ask that the man of the house, the men of the house who were angels, be sent out so that they could know him. He would have understood that. He would have known that there were those similarities there. But there are differences with the Genesis 19 story as well. The first one, I think, is that in Sodom, the men of the town were not part of the tribe. They were not part of Israel. They were those people out there. They were those people who were sinners. They were those bad people. Now, we see that the people of town are part of the Israelites. They're part of the clan. So now sin is right inside the group. And they're part of God's chosen people, and yet they're behaving wickedly. The wickedness that existed outside the camp is now inside. It always had been, but this was a great realization for them that it was there. It was a very visual representation. The other part in Genesis 19 is that In Sodom, the angels blinded the eyes of the men so that they could escape, so that the people in the house could escape and get away. No doubt, the Levite was hoping that this would happen. Perhaps he's praying really diligently for the first time in a very long time. God, please deliver us. Please bring blindness upon these worthless fellows so that we can be delivered, so that we can escape. And yet, the blindness never comes. The mob continues to pound on the door. They're demanding that this man go out to them. Continuing on at verse 23, it says, "And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing.'" So the master of the house is pleading with them, "Please don't do something so wicked. Please stop this." I suspect these two men in the house, the Levite and the sojourner, are working as hard as they can to try and reason with these men outside, to get them to understand what an evil they were committing, trying to get them to see that they were behaving badly. And yet nothing was working. The man's virgin daughter and the Levite's concubine and the servant were probably cowering in the corner, scared, not knowing what was going to happen. Voices were probably escalating, getting higher and higher and higher. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Everybody's afraid. But the reasoning isn't working. And so we read on in verse 24. It says, "Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out to you. Now, violate them and do with them what seems good to you, but against this man, do not do this outrageous thing." Now the master of the house goes one step further. He offers up the two girls, the two women of the house, to the band of worthless fellows. What sort of twisted hospitality is that? Rather than continuing to try and reason with them, rather than trying to find a way of escape, rather than kind of trying to stay them or delay them for a while, he offers up these two women. The master of the house says, "Violate them and do with them what you will, but against this man, do not sin. Do not do this outrageous thing." Hearing this, I suspect the girls, these women, these young women, the anxiety they were already experiencing probably broke forth into full-forced wailing, pleading with these men who were supposed to be protecting them, "Please don't do this. Please don't send us out there. Please protect us." They knew what would happen if they went outside. And yet, this man had offered them up. The worthless fellows, though, continued to demand the Levite. The voices continue to escalate. The demands become stronger and stronger. The pleas from inside become more and more persistent. But in verse 25, we read, "So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night long until morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go." This man, this Levite, this priest of God, grabbed his wife and dragged her flailing body to the door. She's pleading with him, looking at him, saying, please don't do this. Please don't do this. And he grabs her, and he opens the door, and he shoves her out into the darkness, into the waiting hands of these men. And he shuts the door again and retreats back inside. The worthless men of the town were no longer pounding on the door, but it was not quite yet a silent night. From inside the safety of the house, from their beds, they could hear the concubine crying out in pain. They could hear her begging these men to stop. Remember, there's no glass on these windows. They could hear her crying out in agony while these men took turns beating her and abusing her and raping her again and again and again all night long, well past the time she's become silent, letting her go only after a full night of heinous torture. We read in verse 26 that at dawn, she manages to make it back to the house. She fell down at the door, and she laid there, her battered and broken body, bruised beyond recognition, until it was full light. She knew that her only hope was to get back to her husband. She knew that even after all this atrocity, her only hope was to get back to him. That was her only hope for safety, her only hope for reprieve. And yet, she almost made it. Almost. Instead, she slowly dies on the stoop of the house, grabbing hold of the doorframe, while her husband lies inside on a borrowed bed. Did he sleep that night? I mean, really, did he sleep that night? Listening to her scream all night long, listening to her cry out in pain, listening to her cries for rescue, did he sleep? Did he eventually try and cover his ears so he did not have to listen to her anymore? So he didn't have to deal with his own feelings of guilt about sending her out into the darkness? We don't know. Let's read on. Verse 27, it says, "And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, 'Get up, let us be going.' But there was no answer. Then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home." So in the morning, after hearing this all night long, he gets up, opens the door, and he sees her lying there. She's probably bloody, most likely naked, possibly dead. But he doesn't run to her side and say, "Are you okay? Is there anything I can do to you?" He doesn't call out to the people in the house and say, "Please bring me some water and some bandages." Rather, he callously stands over her and says, "Get up, let's get going." She doesn't move, so he picks her up, puts her on the donkey, and they head back to Ephraim. I was thinking about this in context, and I was thinking, how could I, with a man standing outside my door, demanding that I go out to him, grab my wife, and shove her out in the darkness, and then when they abuse her, tell her, "Come on, get up, brush it off." I don't understand that. But it doesn't stop there. We read in verse 29, it says, "And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her through all the territory of Israel." So when he gets home, he doesn't even mourn her death. He doesn't bury her. He doesn't call his friends and tell them what has happened. Instead, he takes a knife and he cuts her into 12 pieces and he sends her through the nation of Israel, one part for each of the 12 tribes, hoping to incite them to retaliate against the people of Gibeah. And we're going to find out that's what happens. This retaliation does happen, and yet we must not lose sight of this, ladies and gentlemen, that this was a real person who was abused and cut to pieces. We cannot sanitize these Bible stories. So, as we think about this summer's theme, character in the midst of chaos, where do we even go with this? What do we even do? In other words, having thought about this story, What now? I've thought of a couple things that I think we can draw from this. First, living life without God leads to a progressive decline in character. This is true of societies and it's true of individuals. As we've worked our way through the book of Judges, we have seen that the Israelites turn from God in more and more and more depraved ways. Things get darker and darker and darker every time they turn from God. You know, in some respects, this abomination that's occurred should shock us completely, and I hope it does. But in other respects, without God, when we have everyone who is doing right in his own eyes, and we are a sinful people, this is what we should expect will happen. The Benjaminites were a people who were living in Gibeah, and though they were part of the tribes of Israel, they weren't pursuing godly lives. They weren't pursuing godly character. Indeed, through the generations, we've discovered that these people have moved further and further away from him. You know, this has happened again and again, not just to Israel, but to man in general. If you read anything of the history of Rome, you'll discover this as well. It's happening here as well. We live in a society that's getting further and further and further away from truth. We have people today where truth is relative. Personal freedom triumphs over all, and people fall deeper and deeper and deeper into sin. To consider just one area, let's talk a little bit about sexual immorality. As a society, we're on a continual downgrade. Things that were once considered completely unacceptable now barely get a yawn. We laugh at people with the Victorian prudishness of a couple hundred years ago and think that it's completely unlivable. We find it impossible to believe that people can be faithful to one spouse for six decades. We find that completely unbelievable. Television shows like Glee that would have not been allowed on television 10 years ago now don't even get a mature rating. And yet they openly celebrate teenage sexuality of the darkest perversions. Pornography is rampant everywhere. The internet age has made that even worse. It's everywhere. I was looking up some statistics on Covenant Eyes, which is a website, and I hope these will shock you. For boys and girls under the age of 18, 70% of boys, 23% of girls, have intentionally looked up for at least a period of a half an hour pornographic material on the internet. And they see things of every form and perversion, things like you read about in Judges 19. In fact, only 3% of boys and 17% of girls have never seen internet pornography. Pornography is a $10 billion a year industry in the U.S. 60% of all website hits are for pornography. But it gets worse than that. A 2006 survey revealed that 50% of men and 20% of women who identify as Christian stated that they're addicted to pornography. 1 in 2 Christian men say that they're addicted to pornography. 1 in 5 Christian women. Another study that they cited suggested that 34% of the readers of today's Christian Women magazine had intentionally accessed pornography on the internet. 1 in 3. This is everywhere, people. One other statistic, 75% of adults believe that online pornography is morally acceptable and harmless. It's not harmless. It affects people deeply. Marriages are falling apart because of it. Sexual abuse is on the rise. 1 in 4 girls are sexually abused. 1 in 6 men, boys, are sexually abused at some point in their life, usually by people they know. Often pornography is involved. This is not harmless. The top 3 best-selling books on the New York Times bestseller list right now, top 3 books, 1, 2, and 3, on the New York Times bestseller list right now, are marketed to women, and they essentially talk about a woman who sells herself to a man, high-powered businessman, to become his sexual slave. And women of all ages, married and not, are devouring this book. Failed to be shocked at how graphic it is. I had a friend of mine tell me she saw it at a children's bookstore. This set of books was on sale. And they identify it as just a little fun or a good marital aid. But Ephesians 5:3 reads, "But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you as is proper among the saints." This, again, contributes to sexual abuse, to divorce. There's a website now that is set up for the sole purpose of creating illicit affairs between married people. This is the direction our society is headed. All of this stuff that you think is harmless is not harmless. Be careful what you expose yourself to. God's word provides us with a standard, and he does it for our protection. The second important theme that I would touch on is that we need to make sure we get our priorities straight. This passage makes it clear that people in that region valued hospitality. Indeed, the master of the house was willing to send his daughter outside so that he didn't treat this man poorly. You know, I think often in the Christian life, we get our priorities mixed up. We strain gnats and we swallow camels. You know, we get angry when somebody swears, but we don't bat an eye when little girls are being sold into slavery all over the world. We get mad when somebody makes fun of Christianity on TV, but we don't bat an eye when people around us, every day, people we work with, are going to spend an eternity in hell if they don't come to Christ, if we don't share with them. We've got to learn to love the things Jesus loved and hate the things he hated. Third, we must realize that a person of character loves sacrificially. The worthless fellows in this story were takers. They lived for their own pleasure. They lived to take whatever they wanted, regardless of who it harmed along the way. They lived like men without God. The Levite also failed to live self-sacrificially. And in fact, in the story, we see that he's entirely selfish. He lived to protect himself. When he and his bride were facing a threat, he seized her and made her go out to them. His actions showed nothing of care for her. He cared only about his self-preservation. Even later in the story, we don't see him recognizing his fault in this. And I praise God that the Bible doesn't stop at Judges 19. I think a lot of us would be feeling really hopeless if that's the case. But the Bible doesn't stop there. In the New Testament, this story is turned completely on its head. You know, the Levite, though he's carrying the title of a man of God, sacrifices his bride for his own well-being. When we come to the New Testament, we see that story reversed. We see Jesus Christ, who is the husband of the church, who is his bride, and in the presence of profound sinfulness, when things were looking grim, he could have pushed us out into the darkness and sent us away from him. But what he does instead is he loves us so much, he loved the church so much, that he gave himself up for her. He turned it on its head. He faced the torments. He received the wounds by which we are healed. I think we need to remember this as well. In Ephesians 5, it talks about how husbands are called to live sacrificially just as Christ did, to love their wives like Christ loved the church. Wives are called to submit to their husbands, but the general call is that we're to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. We're to live in love sacrificially, giving of ourselves just as Christ did. You know, it's so easy to read stories like this and feel hopeless. But I want to make a final point, and that's that the story isn't finished. It's so easy to feel like there's so much badness out there, so much depravity in the world, that the future is completely bleak, that there is no hope that anything will get better. For the nation of Israel, they may have felt that way. You know, this death of the concubine, certainly things make things appear really dark, and they were. But the story isn't finished. Being alive at the beginning of the 21st century, things appear bleak for us too. Sexual immorality is everywhere. People look out only for their own selves. Thefts, murders, everything. Prisons, populations are growing by huge numbers. People have messed up priorities, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. We fail to love and give of ourselves because of our sinfulness, but our story isn't finished. If you can identify with one of the characters in the story, your story isn't finished either. If you feel like the concubine who's been broken and betrayed by the people who should love you, your story isn't finished. Or if you can identify with the worthless fellows, if you have sin in your life that is so dark that you hope no one ever discovers it, if you have sin that's so dark you pray that no one ever discovers the things that you've done, your story isn't finished. Or if you're like the Levite who's a churchman who's callously indifferent to the suffering of others, to the brokenness around you, your story does not need to be finished either. If you're like me, you can identify with aspects of all three of those characters. So I want to finish here by reading a few verses from Revelation 21. I'll try and get through these anyway. Which is at the end of this story. Second to last chapter. It's near the end of the story. I want to start reading at verse 1. It says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away.'" Friends, things may seem grim. You may hurt so much that you can't even stand it. You can barely breathe. You may continually damage other people with your words and actions. On the other hand, your eyes may be completely blind to know that this room is full of broken and hurting people. That the world, when you walk out these doors, is full of broken and hurting people. But I want you to know that for the asking, there's one who can heal every hurt, forgive every sin, and dry every tear. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the opportunity to teach your word this morning. I thank you that you have just given your word for our edification. God, I thank you that you've given your word for just for us. God, there are dark stories in your word, and help us to understand that you don't condone those things. God, they help us to understand more about our character, that we are dark, God, that we are sinful, and that we are in need of redemption from you, God. I pray that you would remind us of this every day of our lives, that you are the God who wipes away every tear and heals every wound. I pray this in your name. Amen.